Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Welcome, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, New Zealand, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's not only fluoridated, it's also Fukushima irradiated, which is good for the economy, according to John Key, because everybody now can get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is Sarah Miles, and I believe she's coming in from New Zealand as well. Sarah, welcome to the program.
Hi, Vincent. Yes, I'm in the earthquake-torn city of Christchurch. It's a beautiful day today, and great to talk to you.
All right. Glad to hear that your voice isn't too shaky.
No. Are you hearing me loud and clear?
Just nicely. As loud and clear as a 6.4.
7.1, actually.
Yeah, those are nasty too.
Indeed. Yeah. Great to have the opportunity to talk to you. I should probably let your readers or your listeners know that I wrote the book, The Christchurch Fiasco, The Insurance Aftershock and Its Implications for New Zealand and Beyond. And I wrote that book as a response to some of the difficulties that we were encountering post the earthquakes, with particular reference to the insurance industry and the government response to events here in Christchurch.
That's actually something I mentioned on the show yesterday.
Mm-hmm.
Just coincidentally. Would you be able to turn your speakers down a little bit? It's feeding back a tiny bit.
Let me see.
Just turn down your volume. Should be straightforward. That's perfect. No feedback. Okay. Well, just to give the listeners a little bit of a heads up, you know, the Christchurch earthquake, this is the irony about it to me, Sarah, is that the government is touting it as the key to economic recovery, the Christchurch rebuild. Everybody's making money from the Christchurch rebuild. And so I theorize, well, whenever we're in an economic crisis, why don't we just blow up a city and rebuild it?
Well, certainly natural disasters would fall into the same category as war zones in that respect. And you know, normally a war zone is a perfect catalyst to get an economy back on its feet. So I suppose you could argue that indeed post-torn natural disaster environment is a good environment in which to stimulate the economy. Whether or not you're implying that this was created purposefully, well, you know, the jury's still out on that one. And I'm not really here to propose that it was, but that's certainly one of the theories that you hear around the place.
Yeah, we've had a number of investigative journalists on the show that have noted things of a suspicious nature, like the fact that the army was, they had 1,000 troops in Lyttelton Harbour, not like 20 minutes drive from the city on the day of the quake, doing emergency disaster relief drills, you know,
yes.
A whole bunch of convenient coincidences like that. the 9 US congressmen who were here on the day, and the head of the Federal Emergency Management Agency as well, who stayed behind. I think maybe 2 hours before the quake hit, all the congressmen jumped on the plane and went home, and the Federal Emergency Manager guy who manages disasters stayed behind.
And, yes,
you know, I'm all sorts of things like that. But are you aware of these?
Absolutely, yes. But since writing the book, I've talked to many, many hundreds or thousands of people, and I've heard probably everything there is to hear about, you know, what it may be a result of or what it may not be as a result of. But I have to say that my own personal opinion is, all of those theories aside, the post-disaster recovery, which is really my focus of interest, has not gone as well as one would have hoped. So I'm not really here today to talk about what may or may not have been the cause of the earthquakes, but rather, you know, the events that have taken place post-earthquake and how the state of Canterbury, really, and the state of the people of Canterbury.
Now, didn't the Environment Canterbury get forcively replaced by Dame Margaret Baisley not too long before the quake as well?
Yes, that's also correct, yeah. Yeah, but you
now,
know,
how did Environment Canterbury react to the disaster as it came through? I mean, because I was wondering if there was lots of contractors involved. You know, where's all the money coming from for the rebuild? That kind of thing. I'd love it if you could just elucidate, and I'll just shut up for a second.
Well, there's been, I haven't heard much from Environment Canterbury. There's been a lot of discussion about the loss of our democratic rights post-earthquake, and Environment Canterbury was seen as one of those losses. In terms of the events since its disbandment, one really doesn't hear much about Environment Canterbury, you know, apart from the fact that the population bemoans its loss.
That's strange. Well, I think we're still getting a bit of feedback. If you could turn your speakers down just a little bit more.
Okay.
Sorry.
How's that?
Technical difficulties. Testing. It's all G. Okay.
So, you know, the reason I wrote the book was because I was very deeply concerned about the events that were taking place here, and I was absolutely furious at the way in which the insurance industry was dealing with, or my insurer, IAG, was dealing with our claim, or rather not dealing with our insurance claim. And as the process has gone on post-earthquakes, what I've seen is that, when there's no longer government for the people and by the people, we're seeing things like the introduction of charter schools, or the mooted introduction of charter schools in Canterbury and throughout the rest of the country. Now, this is something that the majority of people simply don't want, and yet we see the national government sort of trying to push this upon a population that clearly doesn't want charter schools. So there's a sense that we're being, our voices are being increasingly muzzled, or at least our opinions are being less and less listened to.
Broadcast.
Sorry, what was that?
All of the opinions that just aren't getting broadcasted.
Well, I think they're broadcast, but they're just ignored. You know, there's no participatory decision-making any longer. I would argue that, you know, there's too much power in the hands of only a few, and certainly here in Christchurch, I think there's a feeling amongst many that the government has been supporting the insurance industry to the detriment of the people of Canterbury. In writing the book, I wanted to inform the rest of the country about the things that were happening here, because certainly the media doesn't focus enough attention or enough time on the plight of the people. And the reality is there are still at least 200,000 people in Christchurch who are affected by a lack of resolution of insurance claims, of still living in, you know, damaged houses or houses without water. In fact, I'm speaking to you from my place at the moment, which I don't live in. I'm happen to be here because I'm, you know, this is where I have access to Skype. But the 2.5 years on, many of us are still living in conditions that are less than satisfactory, and there's no end in sight.
Has this been causing a mass exodus of some kind?
I think there has been a very large exodus, and once again, you know, those are questions, quantifiable questions that we don't seem to be to get, you know, real answers to. There's a suggestion that only 14,000 people have left Christchurch. Well, you know, my feeling is the numbers are far, far greater than that. And they will continue to grow, because the more frustrated people get with trying to deal with insurers and watching the bureaucracy and what can only be described as corruption in Christchurch, you know, at the end of the process, you just can't wait to get out of the place. And I think there are many people in that category. In fact, last week alone, I spoke to about 10 different people who were in the process of moving out or planning to move on. And I can absolutely fully understand, you know, why people come to that conclusion or that motivation, yeah.
The question I also want to have on top of that, I mean, if lots of people are leaving, I mean, just from your personal experience being a long-time Christchurch resident, if you walk down one of the main streets or into the supermarket or something, is it noticeable that there's way fewer people than before?
Yeah, I think the traffic levels are down. Of course, there are less roads, and so there tends to be a higher density of traffic in certain parts of the city. But, for instance, you know, I go to yoga. There's a perfect example. And that's probably an age range of, you know, around the sort of late 20s to early 50s. And they've knocked back a number of classes because there simply aren't the people now that there were, you know, pre-earthquakes. So that's an indication. You start to see less people. And, you know, my husband belongs to one of the Rotary clubs there, and there are people leaving, you know. So I'm constantly reminded of the fact that, yeah, the place is thinning out. And understandably so, you know, there is no city centre, and it'll take a good 10 to 20 years to rebuild the infrastructure that was here previously. And for the elderly, who's got 10 or 20 years to wait? Or for the young people, there's nothing here to particularly keep them here. Although, of course, there's a really big drive to try and sell the city to the younger people. And, of course, there are tradespeople coming in all the time to rebuild the city. But we still have a massive labour shortage. That's another issue as well.
Mm. Now, in terms of insurance, this is the reason why you really wrote the book, and this is because of your personal experience with your insurance company, I'm sure, was a big motivating factor in all of this.
It was. Initially, it was the motivating factor. About a year after the event, I was struggling, I can only say that. I mean, I'm a lawyer by training, and I have a really good skill set in which you would imagine that I'd be able to resolve my own insurance claim. But here we are 2.5 years later, and it still isn't resolved. And so in September 2011, I started to write because, you know, as I talk to my neighbours, I live in an area not inside the city itself, but outside the city, in a place called West Melton, which was 6 kilometres from the epicentre of the first earthquake. So we really got a massive bang here, and many houses were damaged and quite a few destroyed. And just watching the way the insurers weren't dealing with me and listening to the stories of my neighbours, I decided that in my frustration and anger, I would start putting down on paper and doing some research as to what I saw occurring. And the reason for this was that it became very clear early on in the piece that what was happening was purposeful. You know, I think in the last 2.5 years, we've had 4 different offers ranging from, you know, 200,000 up to, we're up into the 850,000 at the moment. But you know, at any point, if a policyholder would accept one of those offers, then, you know, you'd be out of pocket by hundreds of thousands of dollars. So it becomes this really unpleasant, slow process of battling your private insurer. So I started to do research into insurance, and I have worked in the insurance industry myself in the past, but at a senior management level and not in claims capacity. So as I started to delve and talk and look in to the industry, what became clear was, well, a number of things. The fact that there are absolutely, you know, internal processes to make sure that this process takes place very slowly. And in so doing, you know, the insurance industry makes profits. So, you know, they deny or they reduce policyholders' claims. They refuse to pay market price for your property. They'll change policy coverage. You might have your own engineering report. They'll ignore your report or tell you that your engineering report doesn't state the facts. They'll simply wait until people give up, and people do give up because, you know, 2.5 years on, it really is a marathon and not a sprint. It takes a lot of energy to keep at it, to ensure that your interests and your rights are protected. I've seen them reduce payments using, you know, depreciation as an argument. They fail to properly investigate claims, or they over-investigate claims.
You know, Sarah, I apologise, but we're coming to break now, and I was just thinking, you know, we're going to need another whole segment, because I loved it how you were just laying out all of the things that they're doing, one after the other, dirty tactic, and it just seems like there's no end to it. So we've got another 15 minutes for you to finish the list. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
Your daily dose of conspiracy and comedy is the Vinnie Eastwood Show. In a world so full of madness and chaos, don't lose your sense of humour or you'll go friggin' nuts. Weekdays 5 to 7 Central on American Freedom Radio.
The word is about, there's something evolving. Wherever may come, the world keeps revolving. They say the next big thing is here, that the revolution's near. But to me it seems quite clear that it's all just a little bit of history repeating.
Rest assured, ladies and gentlemen, whatever you have heard before, I can guarantee you it'll happen again. Because history doesn't necessarily repeat itself, but as a wise man said, it sure does rhyme. You ever heard of shock doctrine? Shock doctrine's great. Massive disaster happens, gives you all the excuses you want to come in, send in the troops, take everybody out of their homes and put them in FEMA trailers. Katrina, remind anybody of this? No? Well, Christchurch is a very interesting example. I think it's, as Sarah Miles said over the break, disasters bring out the best and the worst of people. And the type of things that are happening with the insurance companies, everybody's been in a job before that they didn't like the policies that were being set forth. but you couldn't really just quit your job, or maybe you hadn't had quite enough of this yet. And before quitting, you wind up doing a lot of damage to yourself because you have to sit there and you have to deny good people what they're actually entitled to when you're a good person and by your heart you want to help them. And so it weighs on your conscience. And so you have to find some way of dealing with it while you're continuing to do this job. Some people smoke, some people drink, some people eat. But apparently it is very much wearing on some of the employees of the insurance companies, and you can just imagine what it's doing to those who are actually being denied their insurance. Sarah Miles, welcome back.
Thanks, Vincent. Yeah, I was just thinking during when I was listening to the break, the word conspiracy came up there, and I had to sort of laugh to myself. And these days, conspiracy has almost come to mean the truth in many respects. We hear so little of the actual reality on the mainstream media these days, and I find it extraordinary that the word conspiracy is linked to essentially truth telling. I mean, I don't believe that what I'm telling you today falls into the category of conspiracy in any way, shape, or form. So, you know, this is my truth. This is the truth of many Cantabrians, and I wouldn't put it into the category of conspiracy. And I think it's sad that truth these days has become conspiratorial in many camps. Mm. So,
may I just inject something there? Because the technical definition of a conspiracy is two or more people coming together to cause harm on another group of people, without that group of people really being aware of what they're doing.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of things are conspiracies, even very simple crimes. And in fact, you know, conspiracy is a crime, right? You could be charged with conspiracy to commit murder, conspiracy to commit racketeering, you know, stuff like that. And the other interesting part about the term conspiracy theorist is that I think the person who first used it in public was a guy named Richard Milhouse Nixon. Over the Watergate affair, he says, I am innocent and those people are just conspiracy theorists, using it to demonize them. And it's been used ever since.
Yes.
I proudly call myself a conspiracy theorist because my definition of it is a person who believes that there's powerful people who have a lot of influence who use their power to maintain or grow their influence. And so that basically seems like the general running of society to me. People are always being conspired against, but
yeah. And I suppose you know, on that definition, I would say that indeed I see conspiracy happening in New Zealand currently, to my great sadness, really. In terms of the insurance industry, what I would say is that there are some great older insurance employees who are retired and who have come out and who are working for the people of Christchurch, who are not affiliated with any insurance companies and who have taken it upon themselves to go out there and assist the citizens of Christchurch. And of course, there are far too many of them to be able to make a massive difference, but there are a few who are certainly affecting the lives of tens and tens of Cantabrians in assisting them to help them work their way through the insurance quagmire. Yeah, and who have said to me that they're deeply embarrassed by what they see occurring within the insurance industry in Christchurch.
Now, in terms of this, that you're kind of pointing to the examples of some of the best people that come out in light of these disasters to, you know, help their fellow man. They're retired, they're not really in it anymore, but they can certainly help the process along. So they come out and they do it because they can. And also the insurance companies are also doing what they're doing because they can.
Mm,
who's holding them to account? Where are the authorities in all of this?
This was one of the major reasons for writing the book, because as I started to look around in order to assist my own insurance process, what I discovered was that actually there is no policyholder protection in New Zealand. And, I'm living in a city where there are people living in uninhabitable homes who've lost jobs, who are paying rates and mortgages and rent on top of temporary accommodation. There are people going broke. And you go as a policyholder, you go looking for somewhere to assist in helping you with your problem. And you quickly discover that, you're only, when you're talking about major natural disaster, and the average house price in Canterbury is now $400,000, if your house has been majorly damaged, you're looking at a sum of money, normally well over $200,000. And in that event, the district court is no longer available to you. You have to go to the High Court. And the fees involved in a High Court trial, you won't see any change from $70,000. And the average householder simply doesn't have $70,000 to throw at a High Court hearing. We do have an insurance and savings ombudsman, but that ombudsman is an industry-funded, so it's funded by the insurance industry. It's an industry-funded ombudsman, which in my opinion is not independent. You know, how can you have an independent ombudsman if it's funded by the industry? And the same
goes... I would say it depends on your position of independent, whether it's not dependent on other people or it's supposed to get other people independence.
Well, if you look at the statistics of claims heard and settled, I mean, I can't remember the exact statistics off my head, but I think in 2011, 14% of policyholders won their hearing at the ombudsman, as opposed to 67% of the insurance industry. So, you know, the statistics would indicate that the ombudsman definitely tends to favour the insurer over the homeowner. So there's absolutely no independent complaints process. The ability to have class actions in New Zealand is also not really a possibility. There's been a class action bill sitting waiting in the wings since 2009. And of course, insurance is a difficult case in point in that respect because, every insurance case tends to be quite different from the next one. So to bundle them all into one class action is quite complex. We don't have exemplary damages in this country or punitive damages, which are that's a way by which the court will, smack the insurer's hand and say, okay, because you've treated these people badly, we will fine you, if you like, an extra $200,000 or $300,000 or $400,000 as a result of the kind of behaviour we've been seeing perpetrated. In the US, exemplary and punitive damages are used widely, and some of the sums of money involved, I've seen exemplary damages of $1.5 million awarded against the insurer. So, you know, those are clear messages from government and the judiciary that we expect you to adhere to a certain standard of behaviour. And none of these things are available in New Zealand. So the poor old policy holder is at the mercy of these great big corporate giants who, because there are no limitations on the time frames within which they have to have settled a claim, they can just leave these, sitting in the wings for literally years and years and years. And, you know, my situation is also a case in point. I have been talking actively with our insurer since, I think it was, September the 9th, 2010. And yet here we are, we're still battling away.
It's ridiculous. Completely insane. Now, one would only not understand why this is happening if one weren't a sociopathic scumbaggery individual who has little interest in the common good of man, but has a lot of interest in lining his own pocket and, of course, ensuring that he himself doesn't go frickin' bankrupt. Because that's another thing that I found was very interesting about this whole Christchurch rebuild thing, is that a lot of these insurance companies were pleading poverty, like they couldn't afford to pay out and they would go bankrupt otherwise. Is that true?
There are a couple that have struggled, and that's because the legislation in New Zealand isn't tight enough. Our capital adequacy requirements are not stringent enough. Ansbar, which used to insure churches, they pulled out of the market because they simply didn't have enough money to cover the claims. And AMI, of course, which was a major Cantabrian policy holder, they also were going to fail as a consequence of not having enough capital adequacy, and they were purchased by IAG. So, and then, of course, there's Western Pacific, which was a Queenstown-based insurer, and they also ran out of money. So, yes, some of the smaller insurers have failed, and I noticed, I was reading the other day from the Reserve Bank where it was saying that in the event that any of these insurers do fail, there's no obligation by either the banks or the government to bail out policyholders. So if one of these insurers goes belly up, there is the potential that policyholders will be left out of pocket. And it's for that reason, and also for the reasons that I've been talking about, you know, the lack of good faith, the lack of sort of policyholder protection and reasonable dealings by the insurance industry with policyholders, that I feel that we should reintroduce a public insurer in this country. That we no longer need private insurers, but we start looking after ourselves.
Now, in terms of the people working for these companies who are making these decisions, somebody signed a piece of paper. There is a signature somewhere on a document saying, please don't give people their money. Don't instantly take their claims, give them the runaround, something to that effect. There must be something like that somewhere within company policy, wouldn't there?
Well, I'm not sure whether the claims staff on the bottom rungs are necessarily aware of senior strategy. But certainly in the dealings that I've had with our insurer, there's evidence of deliberate slowing the process down. Like you see words like, well, just write them a holding letter, you know, things like that. Yeah. I think
My point is, it appears to me to be a form of criminality to charge money for providing a service like, say, anything like insurance or whatever, to not do the job and then to wait out the people. I mean, that's like tantamount to me. That just sounds a lot like extortion to me, really. I mean, gangs do it to people all the time. People made that policy. Somebody within that company made the policy. But the problem is people don't get personally held accountable when you're taking a corporation to court. And there's nobody afraid of going to jail because all you're doing is wasting the company's money with several $100,000 fines or whatever, if that be. It's a really complicated situation. We'll be right back. Sarah Miles from Christchurch is my guest.
ladies and gentlemen, do me a favor, smash the television and burn the newspaper. That shit will never tell you that the president's a traitor. Believe what you want, but my evidence is greater. What you know about the Bilderberg and New World Order? What you know about the real fluoride in your water? What you know about the breed of uranium in the mortar? What you know about AIPAC controlling the reporter? What's wrong
Welcome
with
back.
The world? People kill people.
Welcome back, people ladies and gentlemen, to the show that's all about keeping it bankster. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. And my very special guest is Sarah Miles. Now, this is... I was trying to say over the break about, you know, just basically a person versus a corporation. You know, a person can act with criminality inside a corporation, and the worst thing that can really happen to them is they get fired, or maybe the corporation will get a few fines. In the meantime, people are literally suffering, and in some cases committing suicide and having their entire lives destroyed and things like that. It's tantamount to a criminal act of scumbaggery of untold proportions.
And yet, no doing anything about it.
No fracking accountability. That's what I don't get. Well, actually, I do get it because I happen to believe that the country is run by ruthless criminal sociopaths. And the evidence for that is astounding everywhere you look.
Yeah, and, you know, the other problem is that I think as a population, New Zealanders are really apathetic, and it won't be until New Zealanders stand up, you know, put their feet on the ground and say, actually, this is not what we want. This is not what we're about. We expect more accountability. We don't want charter schools. We want some policyholder protection so that if we are going to continue to run with the system, that there's some serious accountability, that when we see breaches of good faith by the insurance industry, that somebody's going to, you know, slap them on the hand and tell them that this is not the kind of behaviour we expect towards our population. We've paid our premiums and we expect more than this. And that's one of my great frustrations in Christchurch, is that people are suffering terribly, and yet it's very difficult to get a groundswell of public voice or public sentiment. There's a lot of fear here.
Can I offer another observation? Maybe the reason why you're not having quite so much of a groundswell of support is because having to go through this entire process has depressed the living hell out of people, and they can barely even bother to get out of the house, let alone get out and protest.
Yeah. Well, that's very true. It takes an incredible amount of energy to keep this battle up, and it is a battle. You know, you just getting information from EQC, which is the Earthquake Commission, you know, it takes months, and it's information that you're entitled to. The whole process is so terribly flawed.
Well, it's prone to letting people basically be out in the cold, like literally in Christchurch's case. Can we propose some solutions here? Have you come to conclusions from your books? What are the core problems? I mean, if you were Queen Elizabeth for a day, and you had the umpteen power and you could crack your scepter and just make it happen, what are the policy implementations that you would put in to protect people from having anything like this happen in the future? And secondly, maybe policies that would currently punish people who are perhaps guilty of any form of scumbaggery related to this case?
Well, I think there are several things. First of all, there needs to be regulatory change. We need to see oversight and transparency within the insurance industry. It's not good enough just having an insurance ombudsman funded by the industry. We need an insurance commissioner, somebody who is independent of the industry, who really has the policyholders' interests at heart. And we need, our insurance legislation is pretty weak in comparison with some of the things that they're proposing in Europe, like Solvency II legislation. We really just need to beef up our regulation. I think also that legislative change is required. We need a policy holder forum, somewhere to discuss how we might protect policy holders. you know, justice in this country is no longer affordable for the average family. $70,000 is not the kind of reasonable option if you have an issue with your insurer. I also think that there's been so much mucking around with building codes throughout this whole process. You know, the building codes have changed at least three times in the last 2.5 years to the benefit of the insurers and to the detriment of the equity in the property holders' equity. I think also that, you know, we've learned a lot about the nature of the land in Christchurch and the nature of the geology, if you like. And I think that all this information should, there should be a public database which is accessible to everybody in the country, and in which information about all parts of New Zealand are entered, so that when people are buying property or building houses, they can go and have a look at the various areas and make you know, clever choices about where they build, you know, clearly with the tsunami risk, the east coast of New Zealand is probably not the best place to be building coastal properties. And yet we see time and time again people putting, not mitigating the risks that they should perhaps be mitigating. And in light of the fact that we are seeing more and more climatic global events, regardless of what they're caused by, you know, there's going to be an increasing incidence of flooding, of earthquakes, of hurricanes, or, you know, these sorts of things. So we need to be mitigating some of these problems for ourselves. Climate change is the number one risk to the insurance industry now. And so I believe that we really do need to find our own national solution for insurance, because when things get bad enough, the first people to leave New Zealand will be the insurers. So, you know, we have to find a way of mitigating these risks for ourselves. And I think one of the ways in doing this is to redefine the role of the current Earthquake Commission, which started out well in 2010, but is, you know, failing abysmally now. And I think there needs to be far more public awareness of the role of EQC and what a well-functioning EQC might look like, and how they might be able to assist the New Zealand situation. Yeah, so I think what we need is a system that protects the citizens of New Zealand. And currently what I see are systems that don't work towards the protection of their citizens. I mean, citizens here in Christchurch are having to fight for every last cent of money that they're actually entitled to. And I think that's really wrong.
Mm. Sounds like serfdom.
Yeah, it feels like it sometimes. And yet, you know, I noticed that IAG in 2012 reported profits of $105 million before tax. All of the insurers to date, you know, they're in the green. They're making plenty of money off of this. And we see the new introduction of fixed sum insurance. And probably the rest of New Zealand hasn't taken much note of these things, but that's going to have dramatic impacts on the amount of premium you're paying. And the reality is it will also affect, in the event of a natural disaster, policyholders will find themselves out of pocket even more, because fixed sum insurance is certainly not the panacea for all of the problems that we've had in Christchurch.
You know, it's a terrible story. You know, my sister lives in Christchurch and told her to get out, but she won't. And here's the thing as well. It's the second largest city in the country. Mm. It's practically being left to the dogs in
in Parliament, in the companies, that kind of thing, and the people just being left out. I heard that the red zones basically are off limits to protests as well, you know, like the general city gathering areas where protesters normally gather together for big marches and what have you. That's off limits. So there are so many things happening to the people of Christchurch right now. It's like being in an Iron Maiden, and every single spike that's inside this this coffin that you've wrapped in is designed specifically to penetrate some vital organ of people's liberty and democracy, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true. I think we're seeing a very rapid abuse of our democratic rights, and charter schools is a perfect example of that. And for me, charter schools really represent the risk to democracy. You know, we've got a whole population saying, well, no, we don't want this. And yet there's a clear evidence that the national government will push this through, despite the fact that there are many good reasons for not wanting such a change. The situation here sometimes feels hopeless, and I find it very extraordinary that there's so much emphasis placed by Sarah on rebuilding the central business district, and yet there are so many disaffected residents in Christchurch itself and the wider regions, and yet they're pretty much left to their own devices.
Now, Sarah, lastly, just very quickly, what is the name of your book and where can people get a copy?
The book is called The Christchurch Fiasco, The Insurance Aftershock. It's available in Paperplus, Whitcalls, it's published by Dunmore on the Dunmore website, and I have a really active blog called The Christchurch Fiasco.
All right, thank you. Sarah Miles, see you again sometime.
Great, Vinny. Nice to talk to you.
Gentlemen, to hour number two of the fastest 2 hours in talk radio. It's the Vinny Eastwood Show, the lighter side of genocide. Because in a world so full of chaos and madness and scumbaggery, if you lose your sense of humour, you'll go friggin' nuts. My very special guest today is Mo Bedard, the Gnostic warrior. If you are an enemy of his, then you are truly a mofo.
good one. Wise guy, huh?
I'm not that wise, although I have been called that before. Anyway, Mo, would you please elucidate just on who you are and what it is you do?
Sure, definitely. My name is Mo, as you had mentioned. I got into the truth movement about 6 years ago or so when I started a website called loansafe.org. And it's a website here in America that helps people with their mortgages because there was a foreclosure crisis. And, you know, I had interviewed you yesterday, and I know you'd seen a gap in the market. You were watching Alex Jones, you know, and you were into what people were doing, and you wanted to do something yourself and create something. So you saw a need there in New Zealand. And I saw the exact same need here in America for a mortgage website that helps people through the foreclosure process. So I started a blog, and then that turned into a forum, and that turned into sort of a movement. And that's kind of led me to where I am now. And then I started the Gnostic Warrior, which is really just centered around knowledge, gnosis, which is knowledge of thyself, and then also exposing the secret mysteries and some of the magic that's being played on us right now as a society and a people.
Mm-mm-mm.
So that's a little bit of a
like back. Like the magic of money creation, for example. Man, I wish I could just make up $100 million.
Yeah, what people need to realize, and of course, running LoanSafe, my website with the mortgages, you kind of see what's going on. I've been there from the beginning in 2007 when the crisis started, and with the banks and the trillion-dollar bank out, them going to Congress and, you know, saying, hey, we need X amount of dollars to help some of these homeowners. And, you know, they promised, hey, yes, we're going to help the homeowners. And then turns out they did nothing to help the homeowners with that money. And it went to offshore banks. And Bernanke was being interviewed by the Senate. And he said, hey, we don't got to tell you where it went. It's none of your business. It went to banks. None of it went to homeowners. We don't
Mr. Bernanke, where did all the money go? Forget about it.
Basically. So you see that time and time again, and you're in the thick of it, you know, and I know as yourself in the truth movement, and it's just one after the other, and you start deciding to pull the veil yourself and start looking behind, you know, the powers that be in the media and find truth yourself. And thank God for the internet. We could do that now and connect, you know, you in New Zealand, me here in America, but also to research, you could find out a lot of interesting things on the internet. And it seems like it's a no holds bar on truth and, of course, misinformation as well. And, you know, the Gnostic Warrior, my theory with that website is to cut through the bullshit and give the real truth of what's going out there and the magic and the esotericism that the magic trick that people are under, the magic of money, the magic of thy selfish, you know, just going after that next car, that next house, you know, that next lady instead of, you know, loving your wife, the woman that's next to you and the family that's next to you. It's always that next big thing outside of yourself. And I'm more of looking inside of yourself and empowering yourself and realize what's being played out there as far as the money goes and the corporations and, you know, the vaccinations and, you know, all these truths. Don't let it, you know, inundate you with fear, but use it as knowledge to be a warrior in the society, because it's really hard to escape it. It's almost impossible if you live, you know, in a country such as yourself in New Zealand and then me here in America, you can't really escape it. But my theory is that you could use that knowledge that we're gathering and be a warrior and defend it and still be happy. And, you know, as long as I'm not being put in a camp, and my family's not being threatened immediately as far as they're coming here with needles sticking vaccinations in them, we can still refuse them. You know, so there's a lot of things that I believe that we have as far as free will that I believe we could use and fight the system, you know, ourselves. And it starts with us, our families, and then, of course, with shows such as yourself that you're doing right now. I mean, you're educating millions of people. I mean, over the years, it's crazy. And I'm doing the same thing. I started with mortgages, and now I'm doing it more with the esoteric and the magic and the knowledge of thyself. And that's the big secret that they've been keeping from everybody. And I know you could see my shirt here. Do you know who that is, Vinny?
Baphomet.
You got it. And who do you think Baphomet is?
I think he plays for the basketball team, the New York Baphomets.
You got it. No, Baphomet, it's been, you know, the conspiracy out there is that it's Satan. It's a satanic symbol, and the Templars, the Knights Templars, worship Satan. And, of course, Baphomet would represent Satan. And actually, it's a representative of us. And that's the big secret. And that's what people need to realize is what you see is not what you get. And you know this. you know, your listeners, I know they know this, they're smart enough because they listen to you and yourself, is you always got to look behind the veil. So if they're telling you this is Satan, you know, it's not really Satan. I'm going to research into this and look into it. So I've done that myself, and I pretty much pieced everything together of who Baphomet is and the story behind it and everything. But it basically started out with an occultist named Elpheus Levi, who had drew the picture of Baphomet, and it was just a hieroglyph, and it represents us as man, and we're somewhat of a beast. You know, we're always fighting with that animal nature that we have, you know, and I fought with it a lot of my life, so I understand that from the drinking and the drugs. I've had problems with that. I was a chubby little fat kid for a lot of my life until later on, you know, so there was a lot of things that I could relate to as far as the beast inside of me. And, you know, the anger that I would have, you know, I've been in trouble with the law, I've been in fights and that kind of thing growing up in Southern California in not the greatest of neighborhoods. And so I understand that side, and it was always the side that brought me down. And they basically, the occultists and the esoteric, it's the occult, it's the hidden, you know, and that's what it's about. They hide things in plain sight. And what this is basically, this is a representation of man. This is the spirit. And these are actually two horns inside of our brain that are called the Amon's horns. They're the hippocampus. And they have a lot. You probably don't hear me. Can you hear me okay? I'm up there talking.
Yeah.
But anyways, it has to deal with our brain and a hippocampus. And that's where a lot of our memories and processing comes from. Everything comes from the hippocampus and the ancients.
I thought I saw something. Was that Baphomet thing that you got on your t-shirt wearing a Masonic apron?
This one was, yeah. This is actually it's a painting. It's a famous painting from a French anti-Masonic and anti-Catholic guy from France named Leo Paxil, who had wrote a book against anti-Masonry and stuff. So he took it as an anti-Masonic, you know, they worship Satan. So that's where the worship of Satan comes from. So I told you where Baphomet had came from. The original drawing was from Elpheus Levi, who was an occultist. And then later, this guy comes in, and he's anti, you know, the Masons and anti the Templars and anti this. So he says, hey, this is Satan. They worship the devil. So that is where the conspiracy started, right here with Leo Paxil. And it's basically... The Mysteries of Freemasonry Unveiled was the book he had wrote, and it's Les Mysteries de la Franc Macarena. I can't say it really that great, but Baphomet, actually, it's Latin, spelled backwards. It's Tem Of Ab, and in Latin it means Temple Omnum Hominum Pada Abba. It's Father of the Temple. Father of the Temple is it's us. We're the fathers of the Temple. And what people don't understand is that's where our power comes from. It comes from within. And that's what the religions and everything have been hiding from mankind for, you know, the past 2,000 years. You know, they conceal it in they do have it in the Bible. They have a lot of esoteric teachings that people don't understand that teach you about this. But it's really knowledge of thyself. And they've been keeping that. It's, you know, go to the preacher, go to the church and find out about everything. Go to church to be saved, you know, go to work to earn money, go do this, go do that. It's never here. It's never inside. And that's where really our power comes from. You know,
go to the lodge to be saved. Go to Bohemian Grove to be saved.
Correct. I'm not a Freemason. So, you know, I'm not a Freemason. I'm not a member of any kind of society or anything. I study it very religiously because I want to know who's ruling us, and I want to know some of the secrets. And right now, I believe we live in the apocalypse. And what, you know,
The revealing of great truth.
Correct. It's the apocalypse is the unveiling, is what it means. And what people don't understand is that we're really under the spell of ISIS. And it's really hard to explain in an hour. Maybe we could do it in another show, but basically ISIS is... she's an ancient Egyptian goddess. She was a goddess, a Sumerian goddess, Ishtar, Ashtar. And that's who we celebrate Easter now. And that's where it comes from. Easter is a derivative of Estor. And that was a old English word, and then it developed into Eastern. It's a fertility goddess cult. And that's what the Catholic religion basically is. It's the cult of Isis. And we're under her veil. And that's who you see, like, when you come to New York Harbor. Who do you think's holding that statue?
Columbia.
It's a statue of Isis. It's Columbia. It's all the same. You know, it's... It's just, you know, that's the big thing. We're just under that spell. And, you know, I want to wake some of the people up that understand this and want to look further into it. And I have the kind of love-hate relationship with the society, and I think you do too, you know. But I've researched, you know, our world for the past 3,000, 5,000 years, and we've lived through some hell. You know, we're on radio here. Sometimes I say some words that I shouldn't, but we've been through hell. And we're actually, what we're going through now is like nothing compared to what our ancestors have been through and what they had to live through constantly, day in and day out. I'm not saying it was like that constantly, but literally 5,000 years of war.
I heard something real funny, bro. Like, you know, back in the days of real actual serfdom, when there was like a lord and everybody else was the slaves working on the plantations in England and what have you, apparently they only worked 3 days a week, and it was for 4 hours a day, and all the food that the lord had access to, like duck, geese, and things of that nature, you know, lamb and everything, they also had access to. So who's more enslaved now?
Yeah, no, there's, I know there's been societies in different periods over the last umpteen thousand years. Who knows how long we've been here? We're basically, I feel, we're kind of born into a conspiracy where it's, you know, we're kind of born upside down, and you kind of got to have to look at the world that way. What you're told is not what you get. Hey, look at that. That's not really that. It's really this, you know, kind of thing. But it's, you know, something that we need to realize that we're born into, and it's this massive kind of conspiracy. And sometimes, you know, sometimes I look at it and it's almost for our own good. I don't think all the bad things are, you know, that you talk about and the things that you're doing. I completely disagree with that. I think anything non-free will is nothing the power should do. So I don't know what they're spraying on us up top, but I've been looking at that for 3 years, you know, and I've seen the videos and I've seen you talking about it and, you know, constantly doing your activism for it there in New Zealand, you know, and I've done my videotapes here, and it's almost like you're powerless against some of the things, you know. And then I realize I'm not dying. It's like they're doing something genetically to us, you know. And you know, I know I'm kind of getting into the DNA part, but a lot of that has to play in who we are as well. And that's kind of the big secret. Is there's been kind of like a 3,000 to 5,000 year war, and I feel we're kind of coming to the end of that, the culmination. And we might either see that, you know, that rumor, the conspiracy of Albert Pike, the Third World War, or that might just be the BS to kind of keep us in fear and keep us down. And we actually might just be moving towards a better place eventually. But I know it's ugly right now. And I think the truce, you know, with these shows are going to help us in understanding what they're doing, but not let it bring us down and be more of a warrior. And I believe money is a tool that we could use, because they use it against us. So I believe money could be good and it could be bad. It could be bad if you sell your soul for it and you were away from your family all the time and you do things that you normally wouldn't do for money. I'm talking about making money and lots of money in the right way without selling your soul to Satan or whatever you want to call it. And there's ways to do that. And I believe the power comes within us. And a lot of us in this movement, we kind of look out to everybody, you know, for the answers, when really the answers are within. And we got to use that, and we got to do things, you know, like you're doing. You don't have time for a lot of things because you're busy creating. And I'm almost the same way, and I'm getting busier now that I started the things on Gnostic Warrior, and I started a little podcast radio show. And it's a lot of work, but it's gratifying. It gratifies my soul, you know, to produce this work. And I feel that's what we're here for. You know, that's what Vinnie Eastwood is here for. You're here to serve people. You're here. This is your church. You know what I mean? You're in your room and you're broadcasting to thousands of people every week, and millions of people have seen and heard your stuff. So it's incredible.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, you don't need to feel helpless. You know, I was just thinking, like, chemtrails do kind of make you feel a little bit helpless. It makes me feel like I'm the Mujahideen and I don't have Stinger missiles that were given to me by the CIA yet, so I keep getting gunned down by helicopters from the frickin' Russian military. That's what chemtrails are right now. Where are my Stinger missiles, y'all? We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. Gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand. You know, I don't know how many people in the United States have actually been to New Zealand. I would say it's a very, very small percentage of the population, you know, all tucked away up there. Anyway, I would like to get back to, we were just listening to this thing over the break about Alan and Al Gore talking about chemtrails. Basically, Mo, have you got that video ready to play there, like from the start? I think about the first minute of it or something, because he goes back and later on just talk about, you know, gay rights and all this other kind of stuff and examples of why climate deniers should never be listened to, etc. But, you know, For this section, if you could play that, just the very start of it when they're talking about the aerosol engineering stuff, that was just classic. Like, oh my God, oh man. Yeah.
This is Vice President Al Gore on the Ellen Show. This is about a month ago, and welcome to the apocalypse.
Our next guest is the former Vice President of the United States. Please welcome Vice President Al Gore. And what are you... Well, first of all, let me ask you this question, because there's a rumor, I don't know if this is true or not, that some scientists are trying to figure out a way to block the sun to try to slow down global warming.
Yeah, it's a measure of the feeling of desperation that some of them feel.
Are they really thinking they could do that?
Well, some of them are seriously proposing, and I think it's completely nuts.
Yeah.
You know, you put another kind of pollution, sulfur dioxide, up to orbit, the cover the atmosphere, the sky won't be really blue in the way it is now anymore, but it would block out some of the sun's heat so that we wouldn't have to take the difficult steps to stop spewing all this global warming pollution into the atmosphere.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, there are a lot of problems with what they're proposing. It turns out plants need sunlight.
Yes.
It wouldn't stop the acidification of the oceans, and it really should be yet another wake-up call for why we need to stop putting all this pollution up there. We put 90 million tons every day up there, and that's what's drying out the soil.
90 million tons.
Drought last year.
Yeah, well, he's talking about, let's stop the video there, bro. Because when he's saying 90 million tons, he's talking about CO2, you know, carbon dioxide. But geoengineers have stated that they wanted to, like, spray 300 million tons of aluminium and barium and strontium and chromium and frickin' whatever alcium. I mean, unbelievable, man.
Of course, it's always, I think when disclosure, it's always, they always under-disclose, of course. You know, this is the biggest disclosure I think that I've seen on chemtrails yet, and I know you've been in this field and activism for how many years now?
I don't know. I lost count.
But to me, this is the biggest disclosure of a public official publicly admitting on a national show that is one of the biggest in the country here in America that there are chemtrails and there's 90 million, and whether that be 300 or whatever, you know, and he's inviting people to protest it. And here in America, man, people are just pretty much just, you tell people about it, they don't believe it. They just still do not believe it. They could see everything in the air, the same things that we're seeing. It will show them the same kind of things in the media and the links, and they won't believe it. And it's just amazing, you know, and just people are so into their own little world. You know, some of them don't even look up in the sky. They don't even get it. you know.
Ellen went on to say in that thing that, that anybody who denies climate change just needs to be more educated. And, you know, I think the word education means indoctrination, and I think what the problem is with all of these people who won't actually believe the truth even if you show it to them in incontrovertible formats, they're too educated to get it.
No, I agree. That's the thing is I think the education system I know here in America, it's almost I think I seen Jordan Maxwell talk about it one time. You know, you get that cap, you know, at the end of when you graduate, and it's basically it's the capping of your skull almost. You're basically ready to carry bricks up to the pyramid, you know, and that's who we need to realize exactly who we are. And I'm one of those guys that I'm not afraid to admit exactly what I am, and I know what I am. I'm a slave in the system that's called a citizen, you know, and it's a, just a different type of slavery. You know, they have us under money and taxes and stuff like that, but we're somewhat free too. So I've studied history, and slavery has been a, you know, a big thing for thousands and thousands and thousands of years in every culture. And I've done a lot of research in there, and if you've done research, you'd understand. I mean, there's you talk about like the glory days, I guess, of being a slave, and we three hots in a cot. We only work 3 days a week, and we were kicking back with the master, you know, with his daughters or something. I don't know where that fucking king. Excuse me, my language.
I apologize to the affiliates for the nasty language. The Gnostic warrior can be a little bit feisty.
But anyways, yeah, I'm kind of the Matrix. You know, you take the red pill, Neo, you're a slave. You've been born into bondage, you know, kind of thing. And once you kind of realize exactly how that works and realize that money is really the master, and there's no boogeymans or guys out there. If the vaccines, if you want to refuse them, you could refuse them. You don't have to deal with all the fear. The only thing I'm worried about, to be honest with you, is the chemtrails the most, and then the foods. But the foods, I believe, we also could be warriors, and we could eat organic food, and we could do things. So if we're educated and we understand what they're doing to the food, we could eat healthy organic food and stuff like that. So there's stuff out there that's still available to us. And that's what I feel of being educated and having knowledge and then using that and being a warrior and then earning money also in the system, you know, and there's ways to do that where people just kind of need to create. And that is what the system is about. Magic is actually, it's this simple. It's creating man-made things, basically. Something that I think of inside, I create on the outside. That's basically
like a word. Like a word. Yeah, that's why they call it spelling, because you can cast a spell on people with words like Federal Reserve.
Correct. I mean, a thought is nothing until it becomes a word, and then a word could become a book. You know, once you write it down, it could become history. It can become immortal. You know, there's words now and sayings and things that have been said by famous authors and poets and so forth that are literally immortal. And they've made themselves that way by creating that magic. And our voices and the word is the most powerful magical instrument in the world. And it's from day one, they've known that, you know. And that's why you look at entertainers as far as musicians, the entertainment industry, they're really high paid. They're almost the magician high priest of today, you know, because they have so many millions of followers that, you know, they're high paid, and certain people aren't let into the industry and certain people are. And it seems the more devious and, you know, Satanist you are and low grade materialistic kind of person, your music, you're going to be pushed up to the top. And anything that means something and, you know, that meaningful music that we used to have, it's no longer available as it used to be. And those artists you don't hear of as much, you know, and you just need to understand what's going on and don't play into it. Cause you know, music has a lot to do with our vibrations, because everything's energy. You know, Albert Einstein, everything is energy, and that's all there is to it. And we need to understand that. And when you start thinking about that, Vinny, as far as a person and everything around you, and even money and what we do, and you use that in a positive way to influence things, it starts attracting good energy to you. And you're a testament to that, brother. I mean, you talk about, you know, being things happening to you, and you know, you might run out of money or something happened with your car, and your listeners will chip in, help you out. The PayPal screws you for a few months, and they shut down your account, and things end up working out because you're putting positive energy out there, and you're doing that with your voice and your creations. So you're creating this world, the Vinny's world. You know, it's Vinny Eastwood Show. It's this world that you created, and it's a magic.
Vinny's world. It's party time. Excellent.
Exactly. And people need to kind of get off the sidelines, you know. So those people, you know, you're an inspiration to me to start my show that I've just started recently. You know, the blogging I've been doing for a while, and it's easier for me to type and do the written word, but getting in front of a camera or in front of a microphone was a lot harder for me. So, you know, I commend you, and you were an inspiration. I saw you a couple years ago, and I've always watched you because I liked you. You know, I like that you're in this, and you're a nice guy, and that it comes through, and you have a great heart, and then you put a funny spin on some dark matters, you know, and we need that out here, you know, and that's why I tune into you, and I'm sure a lot of your listeners do. So, you know, I'm trying to offer like a different spin as far as my thing is. I want to kind of help go under the veil with people and say, hey, this is really what this means. You know, they say this, but this. And it's not really like it's the knowledge is out there. I'm just kind of putting it together on my blog because I got it from various sources, from books, and I just done the research. And I actually come from a family background that comes from this line of, I believe, that are maybe the powers that be still are what this Solomonic magic is that we're under. So.
Yeah. Well, see, you were talking about scumbaggery. Oh, no, sorry. I just messed that up. You were talking about magical words that, you know, authors will utter, and then they'll kind of be known throughout history forever. I'd love to do that with the word scumbaggery. I would love people to, you know, have it be in common usage, you know. Oh, man, that guy at the coffee shop ripped me off, man. He stole my wallet. Oh, the scumbaggery.
It's one of the, you know, when I first started listening to you, that was one of the first times I've ever seen the word, and it made me laugh. You know, now I'm kind of a little bit more immune to it because I've heard it so many times. But, you know, just your opening, the fluoridated capital, you know, the everything. I think you're doing that, even though you might not realize it now. You are, and a lot of the work we're doing now is going to be on the internet, and it's going to be archived. And when we're long gone, it's going to be here. You know, I had this idea.
Well, apparently, CISPA got passed while the Boston bombings were going on, and everybody was distracted. So, no, don't count on it being up there forever, bro.
I think it's going to go up and down. I think that we might have some type of cataclysm or something, but it'll be either manufactured, but everything's going to be, you know, there's going to be just like on Noah's Ark, you know, there was a couple animals. There's going to be a couple disk drives of everything, and the seeds and the food and a couple Hummers and all that. You know, they've built everything, and they've prepared for if there's ever some type of earth-ending event, there's going to be people that survive, or if the powers that be bring it on. You know, my theory is that I talked to you a little bit about that yesterday, is that we're coming to the end of an age right now. And I know some people might think, you know, hey, new age or anything like that. But if you study history, they actually time it in ages. The ancients and the powers that be understand this. And we're in the sixth age right now. And it started under Augustus Caesar. And he had changed the calendar from the Egyptian calendar when they had conquered Egypt, Rome, to the Roman calendar in 8 AD. And that's the calendar that we've been on. And that's when the sixth age had started. And that's when this kind of magic trick has been kind of played on us, you know. And the goal actually is Pax Romana. And if you research Pax Romana, that's a term, it's Latin for peace under Rome, I believe. I forget what it's for exactly, but it started under Caesar. And, you know, that's what, you know, Rome is, the Pope. He's basically under Caesar's law, you know, and a lot of the nations, you know, a lot of us don't understand, but we're kind of still under that system. And America, you could see it everywhere here. You know, there's a lot of Roman architecture, and you have the, you know, I believe we're Freemasonry. The Freemasons started it, and they're tied into all of this, the powers that be. I don't necessarily think that they're involved with everything evil. I think it just got to a point now where they're actually like Al Gore, we had just played, where they're disclosing this stuff for us to take back the world. They're not going to give it up, but I think they're going to give the truth up, and we're going to find out. And this is the disclosure that we're seeing. And that's, I mean, how are we getting this information? They're giving it to us. The internet's a private domain. They could shut it down anytime. The military started in the Second World War. You know, so this is a private little domain that we're all on that they control, and they're issuing the information and letting us talk about pretty much any subject that we want to.
And recording it all
on that disk, and they're putting it in that underground cave. They have those data centers here. I don't know if you've ever seen it. I don't know if it was Department of Homeland Security or one of those units, those three-letter units. But
fusion sensors and all of that kind of jazz.
Yeah, they have like 6-7-story tall buildings filled with servers that are backing up everything that we're doing right now. And they're all cooled, super data security. And they're doing that right now, every single little thing we do. It's basically, we're all have an IP address, right? So everything we do probably is going into a little folder that's tied to our IP address, any email we send, you know, and then it's just everything's being monitored because the powers that be, want to keep their control, of course. And if you look at the powers, the kingdoms over history, they've always been overtaken by the people. So we've always been the biggest enemy. So that's why there's always been an assault on the people. It's just now it's a soft assault.
A soft assault. I was just thinking about this. How exactly are you supposed to identify your enemy or that you're even being attacked when you don't even know that they're there? You don't even know that they exist. You think everything happens by pure coincidence and accident. We'll be right back after the break at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com.
But I've never been edible. I'm a cracker, not a vegetable, fed to an extraterrestrial. The beat is so electrical, it'll pump your heart ventricles. But I bet you will eject it if I start getting intellectual. I am not yet credible, so until I can say I'm credible, I'll say that I'm incredible, respectable, and professional. Do you read me? Am I legible? It's time to get down to the question of eventually will the corruption in the government lead to the collapse of us? Lead to the collapse of us. Lead to the collapse of us.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, the show that acknowledges that the right and left are symmetrical on the puppet master's tentacle. It's the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Mo Bedard, and his website is GnosticWarrior.com, I believe.
That's it, yes.
Yes. Now, you're talking about how the power comes from within us. And I hold this to be an inherent truth. And I believe that it also implicates that we are not living in a fate-based society, that, like Terminator says, there's no fate but what we make for ourselves, you know, free will, free choice, that kind of thing. You have the choice to sit around and do absolutely nothing, and you have the choice to stand up and accomplish great, massive change in your world by devoting your lifespan to it, okay? You know, that's basically, as far as I look at it, you've been given a lifespan, and you can do whatever you can in that lifespan, all right? You can drive yourself too hard and make yourself have a heart attack at the age of 29 and die. Or you can really take it easy and accomplish absolutely nothing and die at the age of like 80 or something and actually get to enjoy grandchildren of some description. You know, there's many, many, many paths through life. Which one is yours? Is it being a slave that winds up getting exterminated by ruthless criminal sociopathic scumbags wearing black uniforms in a FEMA camp with 500 ovens and massive warehouses with human cages with manacles bolted to the floor or something like that? Maybe that's what you choose to live like in your life, you know? Or you may choose to fight and die on your feet. Or maybe you'll survive. Maybe you'll become a great leader of the resistance like John Connor or something. Who knows? Point is, it's up to you. Nobody can make those decisions for you. You can only make those decisions for yourself. And I think, what was his name? Anthony Robbins, you know, the motivational speaker, Mo. He talks about how humanity has a crisis of faith, not in God, not in government, but in ourselves. And I think that that's very true. We've lost faith in ourselves.
Definitely. And this, actually, I have an ancient Egyptian proverb written down. And this it says, man, know thyself, and thou shalt know the gods. And this is, you know, this is the big secret, and it's not a big secret. And this is where everything comes from. It comes from within, you know, from eating the best foods, you know, to purify yourself. You know, we know the GMO foods and the fast foods and the alcohol and the cigarettes and all that stuff is poison, and that it actually kills us. And it's a scientific fact. So if we avoid those things, we could help purify ourselves. And this is our temple. And we're the father of the temple. We're the Solomons, you know. We're the Solarmans. We could be, you know, they say gods on earth, and that's really the person that isn't affected by the material world, where they could operate anywhere. And you know, when you see Baphomet and you see, you know, George Washington with his, you know, the statue of Baphomet, it's really they've mastered the as above, so below, and they understand that we're really made of stardust. And we humans, even though, you know, we're here in this flesh, it's actually, you know, we're part of the cosmos out there, and we're actually made of stardust, and part of us is actually out there. And if you studied alchemical kind of things in the occult, you'll understand things like phosphorus, you know, Lucifer. Do you know who Lucifer is, Vinny? Well, you know, the common thing is that Satan, right?
Lucifer's is like some kind of light of some kind. That's basically all it means, something to do with, like Lumiere or in the French or something, just means light. And that's what Lucifer is, just light.
Well, yeah, it's Latin for light bringer. And basically what people don't understand, it's for phosphorus. And phosphorus is a chemical that's in our blood, and it causes chemical energy. And that's what we use to create. And when they talk about Lucifer, and you hear that in the Morning Star, they're talking about phosphorus that's inside of us, and it's basically the philosopher's stone, and that's Lucifer. It's just phosphorus, and it's found everywhere in nature. We get it in food, we get it in plants. It's the alpha omega of nature. So when we die, the only chemical that basically gets deposited back in the soil when all our soul is gone and wherever into the stars, the only chemical that's remaining is phosphorus. It gets recycled back into the soil, and then it gets recycled into the plants. The plants get it. We eat the plants. It goes into the animals. The animals eat it, and it keeps getting recycling. And that's one of the nature. That's what makes us man, what makes us conscious is phosphorus.
Yeah, it goes in a circle like shared, you know, hence the saying phos for you and phos for us.
Yeah, and if you look at phosphorus, you know, the name is right there, Horus, you know, and that was in Egypt, that was the son of Osiris, and he was worshipped as a light bringer as well. So they're putting that out right there in front of us. So, you know, Lucifer isn't bad. They don't worship some god or anything out there. They worship thyself. So that's what they're talking about. And it's all right there in front of us. But a lot of us haven't done the research to find those things out, you know. But
And there's two veins of thought that get interpreted off of this thing. One is, I am powerful, therefore I can affect the people around me and really help all of those people. And the other way of interpretation is, I'm all that matters. Frack everybody else. They are mine to manipulate and own and control.
Correct. So we could either be evil, we could be Satan, we could be the evil entity, we could do dark with that power, or we could create light, we could create love, we could create truth. So basically that's where the beast comes in. It's if you master the forces, it depends, you know, if you're working for an entity or some type of a machine that is serving evil, you're serving evil as well, plain and simple. It doesn't matter what you think. You're selling whatever it is, your soul, to work to get money for a paycheck for some evil entity. So if you master yourself, it really means nothing. You're serving darkness. But it, like yourself, you're serving light with that energy. The energy isn't just coffee, brother, that, you know, that 9 cups of coffee that you have or whatever. I know it's not that much, but you know, it's really this phosphorus in us.
No, it's actually more.
Gotcha. That's a little too much, but I'm kidding. That's your choice. Okay, good.
Yeah. See, and there's the other element as well. I feel that people don't really know what they're on about most of the time. And even I admit that I don't know what I'm talking about a lot of the time. Okay. And another thing, you just got to sometimes realize and think to yourself, you know, am I wrong? Am I actually not fully aware over here? I mean, I forget who he was, but he had this great philosophy. It's about the cosmic schmuck, you know, whether you're a really big doofus. And, he's just saying, you know, if I was sitting there and I was thinking to myself, am I a cosmic schmuck? It'd be very unlikely for me to actually wind up becoming a cosmic schmuck because I'm always thinking about it. Whereas if I never think, you know, am I a cosmic schmuck? Then I probably am one and will continue to be until I start questioning whether or not I'm a cosmic schmuck.
No, everybody could be wrong. You know, I mean, I could be wrong on some of the things I talk about, you know, and I know that. But what I tried to do is have the research there. You know, if we're going to do truce, you know, like the person you had on before on your show, she had written a book, real knowledgeable on the subject, Christchurch, what's going on with the insurance companies, you know, defrauding people left and right there, corruption. You know, I kind of do that with my blog as far as having the links to the ancient sources and stuff like that. That kind of put this all together. But, you know, stuff like phosphorus and Lucifer, you actually could find on Wikipedia now. So they're actually doing a lot of these things right in front of us. You know, Nibiru, you know, the planet Nibiru, you know, the people think that's the 12th planet. It's Jupiter. That's it's been known for thousands and thousands of years as Jupiter. And that's been one of the most prized planets for thousands and thousands of years. That's the father god. It wasn't really the sun that they worship. They actually worship Jupiter, and that's the morning star as well. So Nibiru, you know, that Zachariah Sitchin had made famous, and it was the 12th planet, you know, the Anunnaki it came from. I actually believe the Anunnaki came from Jupiter and the Sumerians as well, and that's the planet that they worship. And you could find phosphorus on Jupiter and stuff like that. So Nibiru is Jupiter, and that's the morning star that they talk about in the Bible. But again, people out there, I suggest that you do your own research and find this type of stuff out. You know, I'm kind of into that esoteric stuff, you know, then also kind of the stuff what's going on now, the truce as well, you know, to figure out what's going on and what they're doing to us, the powers that be.
All right, Mo, well, it's been lovely having you on the show today. If you would give out your websites, because I understand that you also offer help and services for people who are going under foreclosure and things of that nature. So rattle them off, mate.
Definitely. Thank you. Loansafe.org. It's LOANSAFE.org. That's a forum for people that might have a loan or foreclosure issue, mortgages, stuff like that. I've been doing that for almost 7 years now. And then my website with a lot of the stuff I'm talking about now is called GnosticWarrior.com. It's with a GNOSTIC, then warrior.com. And then you can find out a lot of the stuff I'm talking about's there.
Mm-mm-mm. All right. Wrapped up in a neat little package. Thank you very much, Mark. And it was good to do that interview with you last night as well, although the video did frack up on us. And ladies and gentlemen, you can witness the magic of the Vinnie Eastwood Show interview on Gnostic Warrior at GnosticWarrior.com as well. Thank you very much for listening. And also just to reiterate to the listeners, this show survives and thrives on your support. If you are capable of subscribing for as little as $1 a month, anywhere up to $100 a month if you can spare it, we'll go into running this show better in a more squeaky clean machine. And we'll give you some commercial free archives for that as well. Listener supported. We'll see you again sometime.